From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tine.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, what happens when you have all the trappings of adulthood, but find yourself unhappy despite them? Author Meg Rozoff's latest novel, Jonathan Unleashed, wonders that too.
Then finding the proper balance to be our healthiest selves.
Wellness sits on a base of four prime pillars. Good nutrition is one. Exercise or movement, stress and sleep management, and balanced metabolism or balanced chemistry is the fourth.
And the songs on singer-songwriter Carmel Michael's latest album are vastly different in sound, but share a vital common thread.
The theme of this album is like people up against a system that's bigger than them, or up against injustice or loss or some kind of struggle, and how they react. And sort of every song takes a different angle on that same sort of setup.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Tine.
And I'm Bonnie North. We first spoke with Meg Rozoff in 2007 when she was touring with her third novel, What I Was. Since then, she's written five more novels, collaborated on three picture books, finished to great acclaim an unfinished novel by her late friend Mal Peet, and appeared in print and on the air numerous times in the British media and in person at any number of literary festivals around the world. The British newspaper The Times says this of her work: searingly well-written, her books read like Samuel Beckett on ecstasy.
Other people think so, too. Last year, Rozoff won the Astrid Lindgren Memorial Award, presented by the Swedish Arts Council, for a significant body of work in children's literature. It carries with it the largest cash prize for literature outside the Nobel Prize.
Although Rozoff was born in the U.S., she lives in London with her husband and daughter. But last fall, she was on this side of the pond to visit her family here, and we reached her via Skype to talk about her latest novel, Jonathan Unleashed, an irreverent and funny look at what it means to be an adult. Meg Rozoff, it is such a pleasure to have you on the line. Always great to talk to you.
Oh, it's great to be back in the Midwest, even if it's only virtually.
I know. Well, we welcome you back. And I was thinking back on the first time that we spoke was about What I Was, and that was, what, 2007?
Oh, my God, it was a long time ago.
Yeah. And then the next time we chatted about a book also had a dog in it. That was There Is No Dog.
But there was no dog, and there is no dog.
Right.
Hence the title.
Hence the title.
I always told the people who did the covers, they always put dogs on the covers, and I kept saying, there is no dog.
Read the title. But there are dogs in Jonathan Unleashed.
There are indeed. They're very important dogs. They're a border collie and a Springer Spaniel. And they are inherited by the main character from his brother, who decides to take a job in Dubai, and he can't take the dogs with him. And Jonathan has never owned dogs before, and so he really has no confidence at all in his ability as a dog owner. And he does what most, or many certainly, dog owners do that I have observed, is he begins to project the problems of his own life into the dogs. And then there is some thought that possibly his dogs set out to sort his life out. But we never really know whether they're doing that or whether he just imagines they're doing it.
Well, they have that wonderful look. The way dogs look at you, you know, it's so easy to anthropomorphize them.
Exactly. And, you know, you see them looking at you in a certain way, and you don't know what they're thinking. They're probably thinking, damn, you know, I haven't killed a squirrel in weeks. But you think, oh, my God, they're thinking my life just isn't worth living. I'm a terrible owner. You know, my job is a ruin. My girlfriend is the wrong person. What I love is that sort of the way humans project onto animals.
And in this case, you're also delving in, well, as a dog owner, you're delving into that part of your life, but also a part of your life that you have happily left, which is advertising.
Yeah, very happily left. And I think they were very happy that I left. They were even more happy than I was that I left. Yeah, I worked in advertising for 15 years. I did a degree in English, and I sort of stumbled around and a bit of journalism, a bit of PR, you know, a bit of publishing through my 20s, and I kind of landed in advertising more or less by mistake. And then I had the misfortune to move to England and marry a very adorable artist But I was kind of the breadwinner. And so, you know, he would sort of skip off happily to his studio every morning. And I went off to work in advertising long after I was over the whole idea that it might be a romantic career. Because, you know, basically, advertising is selling stuff to people that they don't want. Anyone out there thinking of going into advertising, let's just say it like it is. You're selling stuff to people that they don't want, they didn't think they wanted. And, who was it? It was one of the big advertising executives said it was the sound of a stick in a swill bucket.
Oh, God.
Well, so, I'm afraid that's kind of how I... It was very romanticized when I was there. There's all sorts of awards. They call, you know, the people who work in it creatives. But it certainly wasn't my favorite way to spend 15 years, 15 long years. And I got very, you know, disgusted with myself and really thinking that I should be doing something else, but I didn't really know what. I thought of, you know, making cakes and, you know, opening a garden shop. You know, all the things people think about when they think, I've got to get out of this career.
And Jonathan certainly does that. I mean, you have really summed up, I mean, his attitude toward the job that he has, which a lot of people in New York, because he is in New York, and they would think, well, this is the job you need in New York to make the money, to live in New York, to, you know, to have that Manhattan experience. And he is miserable.
Well, you know, the thing about Jonathan, and I think this is what the book is about, much more than, you know, dogs or, you know, coming of age or anything like that. It's about someone who has an idea of what it means to be a grown-up and is following it to the letter. So there's a line in the book, which is one of my favorite lines, where he says to his friend, but I've got all the stuff. And his friend says, what do you mean you've got all the stuff? And he goes, you know, the girlfriend, the apartment, the job. And it's like he's got a tick list of what it means to be a grown-up, and he doesn't understand why, even though he's got all the stuff, he's so unhappy. And it doesn't really occur to him that it's the wrong stuff. And, you know, it's really interesting to me because my daughter is 19, and I'm starting to sort of see the pressure that people put on kids at university. You know, everyone's always asking her, so what are you going to do? What are you going to do? What are you going to, you know, what's your career going to be? Well, she doesn't know. And, you know, the pressure to decide, to have it all sorted out when you're 21 is insane. And, you know, some people kind of know all their life they wanted to be a vet, so they go off and they be a vet. But most people kind of slide slowly into their career. And Jonathan, you know, has already chosen what he thinks is the right girlfriend, the right job, and it's not working out for him. And, you know, for me, that was the most important kind of mistake of my 20s, I would say, and my 30s as well.
Of following that tick box.
Sort of following the tick box, thinking, okay, I'm a grown-up. I've got to have the career. I've got to have the boyfriend. I've got to have the house. You know, luckily for me, I was incapable of getting it all. You know, my boyfriends were so appalling that you could never bring them home. My jobs were even more appalling, and, you know, I never owned a place or anything like that. So, you know, for me, achieving all that seemed a complete impossibility. And then, of course, I started writing when I was 46, you know, which is way past, you know, the age of when you're supposed to figure out what it is you are in life.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people, and I would suggest that, you know, Jonathan fits right into this as a character. A lot of us think it's all of those things. We've got the stuff, but we also think we somehow should know.
Yes.
We should know.
Like,
and
you have a destiny.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I should know what my calling is.
Exactly. And, you know, the funny thing is, as you go through life, you discover that there are jobs you didn't even imagine existed. You know, and how would you know when you're 19? You know, you sort of know that there are six jobs. You can work at 7-Eleven. You can be a lawyer. You know, you can be a lion tamer or a teacher. But what there are 10 million things in between, which often people sort of slowly wind their way towards.
And it's that winding that is so interesting.
Exactly. Is that because that's where you figure out all the really interesting stuff in life? And, you know, I always think it's really interesting when you look at a lot of writers' biographies, they always have things like so-and-so used to be a mortician, a park keeper, a tree surgeon, and a dog walker. And it's sort of that way of kind of, you know, collecting experience that makes people more interesting, not only as a writer, but as a human being.
Well, and you find it's grist for that whatever mill you're throwing it all through. And you can sit there and say, well, this actually feeds me, even if you're not aware of it. It does.
Well, of course.
Yeah.
And you don't have to be a writer. You know, the grist is the grist to being a human. You know, every single thing you do enriches your experience and enriches your ability to be a good person. And, you know, Jonathan at one point says that he wishes somebody had written a book or was giving a course at the New School called How to Be a Person. And, of course, that's the big question. How do you become a person? And, of course, when I was a kid, I used to think, well, you know, at 21, you're a person. You're a grown-up. You know how to do everything. You know how to get a mortgage. You know how to, you know, have children, be married, live a life, all that kind of stuff. Somehow magically, you know. But, of course, it doesn't happen that way. It takes decades, and some people never get there. And you know, and the other thing, I'm ranting now, but the other thing is that there sort of is no getting there. You know, it's the whole process of living is figuring out a little more each day what it is you need, what it is you like, what it is, you know, that makes being a person worthwhile. But, and that's a lifelong process.
Yeah,
and
go ahead.
It doesn't stop when you're, you know, when you're 22 and you've got a job in advertising.
Oh, no, no, I hope it doesn't. I was going to say, I was going to bring in a literary reference and say, a la Gertrude Stein, there is no there there.
Yes. Exactly. And in fact, I won this big literary prize this year, and somebody came up to me afterwards and said, oh, my God, Meg, so how do you feel now that you've hit the plateau of happiness? And I nearly fainted. The idea that there could be such a thing as the plateau of happiness. You know, the plateau of happiness is just, you know, a stopping point on the way to the cliff of despair.
Exactly. You just know that there is a cliff of despair, and many of them.
Of course, because life is like that. It's up and down, and you know you don't get to a point and stick there. You know.
Well, you hope not, anyway.
Well, I guess that's true, and I think the people who do get to that point are usually, you know, often feel that there's something wrong with their life, but they don't know what it is.
Well, congratulations on the Astrid Lindgren Award, by the way.
Thank you.
That is a very, very big deal. And it is for a body of work in basically young adult literature.
Yep. Yep.
Jonathan Unleashed is not. And so it's really kind of fun that you've won this award for the body of your work and that you've already struck out into a different direction.
Well, you know what? This is a point of contention in my opinion. I'm writing the books I want to write. Now, if you look at the ages of my protagonists, some of my characters are as young as a year or 2 years old, and they're some of the most profound and kind of interesting characters I've invented, and they go up as high as, you know, a guy in his 50s or 60s in There Is No Dog. But, of course, publishers have agendas, and they have marketing departments, and they look at the age of your protagonist, and if in the case of Jonathan, he's 24, then it's no longer a book for young adults, it's a book for adults. But, you know, if you read my body of work, you wouldn't say, oh my God, Meg has really struck out in a different direction.
I would agree. I actually would agree, having read all of your books. You just write about people.
Yeah, and I do kind of write about the transition between seeing the world as opaque and starting to develop a little bit of clarity. And, you know, that doesn't happen in a year or 5 years. It doesn't happen when you're a teenager, but it begins to happen. And, you know, I've really noticed, in my 50s that a lot of my friends are going through the same kind of trajectory that teenagers are going through. They've decided they don't want to be a lawyer anymore. They don't want to live where they lived. They don't want to be married to the person they've been married to. And so suddenly they're asking the same questions that teenagers ask, which is, what shall I do with my life? Will anybody love me? You know, you might add again to that. You know, why am I here? And so it's not a specific period in life where all those questions end. But it works, you know, and I wonder what I'm going to do next. I don't really have any idea. But maybe I'll write about people in their 60s having the same kind of problems about not knowing how to be a grown-up.
Well, Meg Rozoff, it is always such a pleasure to catch up with you. The book is called Jonathan Unleashed. It is out and available, and I highly recommend everyone read it.
Well, you know what we forgot to say is it's funny.
It is.
You know, one of the reasons I wrote it was because I thought I was feeling exactly like what you're talking about. I was feeling a bit cynical and a bit depressed about the world, and I thought, boy, I need a good laugh. So if you need a good laugh, I think that's what you should buy it for.
Well, and the dogs, they make me laugh. And his watching them, the way they sort of corral him, as you said, we don't really know whether they do or he's projecting it. But I like to think that they are.
We'll never know, will we?
No, we won't. Not in this life, anyway.
No.
Maybe we'll learn that at some point on some molecular plane. But I like to think that the animals are kind of smarter than we are, actually.
Well, you know what? I did develop a theory at one point, which was that we all think that we're getting dogs to, like, you know, conform to our lifestyle. But in fact, you know, I live in the middle of London in a very expensive apartment now. And, you know, my dogs hate it when I go out, so I hardly ever go out. You know? And now who's trained whom?
Exactly. And when you're up at the beach house, you're out all the time.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Yep.
So, yeah, you know, I think they're really in control. We're an experiment, and they're trying to see how far gullible we really are.
How far they can push it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, enjoy your time on this side of the pond, and we will catch up. I look forward to whatever the next thing is that you write, and I so appreciate you talking with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Meg Rozoff is the award-winning author of, among others, How I Live Now, What I Was, and There Is No Dog. Her latest, Jonathan Unleashed, which has two dogs, is out now. There is more information at WUWM.com.
Coming up next, we'll talk about wellness with a former ER doctor turned preventative medicine advocate. You are listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. It is not too often that a physician will completely change specialties, but local Dr. Philip Troiano, or Dr. Flip, as he's known to his patients, did an about-face after more than 25 years as an emergency room physician.
In that time, he'd noticed the patients coming in were often returnees with poorly managed chronic conditions rather than acute problems like a broken bone or a heart attack. So he decided to find out more about preventative medicine and discovered an entirely new passion.
Dr. Flip spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski about his journey to embracing a different way to practice medicine.
One of my colleagues had started to look into doing some alternative things, and I ended up going to a conference with him. And what I expected was not to be a very robust scientific scenario. And when I got there, I was amazed at the science. We've had science for 20, 30 years about other better ways to do things. And so I began to study and gain the knowledge I needed to do it. Now, I love the emergency room. I'm not one of those docs who, after practicing 27 years, is like, oh, I can't wait to get out of here. I love the emergency room. And I got there because I really like to fix problems. I like new and different things every day. And what happened is, over my time in the emergency room, I found that over time, we were fixing less and less problems and seeing more and more chronic situations where we weren't changing things. We'd see patients back and we'd take good care of them, but we'd see them back weekly sometimes, monthly sometimes, and nothing changed.
Well, what are some of the chronic ailments or conditions that you saw some patients returning with again and again?
Well, everything from congestive heart failure to kidney problems to chronic inflammatory diseases. I mean, the diseases that our society is suffering with are all based on chronic inflammation of some sort.
Okay. So the root cause is chronic inflammation. And did you doubt before your time at the ER about wellness practices or alternative medicine during that time as an ER doctor, since it was just in and out and just a different setting?
Well, 10 years before I did this, I wouldn't have known much about alternative practices. Once I had started to do it, I began to even introduce some of the ideas into the emergency room. A simple example would be vitamin D. Vitamin D is crucial. You need adequate vitamin D for your heart to work. And there are some really interesting studies for neonatal cardiomyopathy or bad heart failure in newborns. They die. And there were some studies out of it was Sweden and Denmark, I think, where they gave these kids 1,000 units of vitamin D and reversed 90% of them. Well, we started to look at some of our patient population when I was at Sinai and found that their vitamin D levels were practically non-existent. And so at that point in time, it's like I'm not sure that you could fix some of those by giving them vitamin D, but it's a start. So I began to talk to my patients about, you can reverse some of these things. And it's interesting to see that when you tell a patient that, you tell somebody who's what they have is a disease that everybody says, well, you're going to have this and you're going to have it forever. When you say, you know what, you might be able to get rid of this, everybody's eyes opened up and say, well, that's a new thought.
Well, do you think we're conditioned to accept that we'll have these diseases for life just based on the medical system and the way people have been treated in the past?
Yes.
So how do we get from there back to the roots of functional medicine? So to start, just what is the basic concept of functional medicine?
Functional medicine is a science-based approach to wellness. It looks for the root cause of the problem, so instead of treating the symptom. An example would be standard medicine will tell you if you have high blood pressure that high blood pressure is a disease. Functional medicine will say high blood pressure is not a disease, it's a symptom. It's a symptom of your blood vessels or your vascular tree being irritated in some way. What you need to do is find out what's irritating it, and when you reverse those causes, your blood pressure will go down.
What are the key aspects of a person's life into maintaining good health? I saw on your wellness page that you have a 5-7-9/65 rule. Is that the basis that wellness practice has, or what do you think is the good?
I mean, that was just a catchy idea to get people to look. I think that the basis for wellness is, you can think of it as wellness sits on a base of four prime pillars. Good nutrition is one. Exercise or movement is another. Stress and sleep management is the third, and balanced metabolism or balanced chemistry is the fourth.
So if we already have the science and ability to diagnose and reverse or alter at least the course of chronic illnesses, why is this not common practice already if it's been around for 20 plus years?
Well, I think that's a complex question. For one reason is that fixing it is not a pill. It's not a simple pill that somebody can make and make a profit on and then give you and you fix it. You have to deal with, how do you deal with stress? Not only, how do you decrease stress, but how do you deal with it? Are you sleeping well? How do you improve sleep? What are you eating? That can be a whole lecture unto itself. Our food now is less nutritious than it used to be. And are you moving? How often do you exercise? I know that everybody says, well, I should be doing it and I need to go to the gym, but they don't get there. So how do you get patients to do that? And how do you make those decisions in your own life to say, I need to exercise. I need to be moving. And actually, I don't even like the word exercise. What happens is exercise becomes work. And when it becomes work, we put it down at the bottom of the list. So I've tried in my practice to eliminate the word exercise. So we talk about FPAs, fun physical activity. If I think of something that I love to do, then it's much easier for me to incorporate that into my schedule and to do that on a regular basis.
Right. Do you think, just as we're kind of conditioned to be in and out of hospitals or maybe find a pill to relieve some ailment, do you think because wellness takes more work on the person's behalf versus I'm going to take this prescription every day, that's also a hurdle for people to get
Yeah, I think that's a hurdle. And I think it's also a hurdle is that the money is not set up to promote wellness. The healthcare industry, it's a business, and it makes money on essentially on people's illnesses. If we get rid of hypertension or diabetes, how do those docs get paid, or how does the system get paid?
Do you find that that is an obstacle for people who may want to go into wellness practices and preventative medicine? But I saw a lot of the things aren't covered by most insurances. Maybe some lab tests are, but really the work and seeing the doctor, that's not covered by most insurance plans.
Well, let's look into those details. First of all, maybe the lab work is covered. Well, that's a huge part because labs are, I mean, and we end up doing a lot more labs. So that's critical that labs are covered. The initial fee is not covered, but we're getting to a point where that's less important for some people because, I don't know, but what's your deductible on your insurance? I mean, many of my patients have $2,000, $3,000, $5,000 deductibles, which means that they pay everything, practically everything up front, unless they have a horrible accident where they end up having to surgery. They're paying everything out of the pocket. And the worst part about it is that they're overpaying for things because they pay what are called the usual and customary fees.
So ultimately the costs add up, yes, but not as much as they would under other plans. Okay. So with insurance companies viewing functional medicine differently and with all of this healthcare reform very much up in the air, how important do you think it is for people to take these adaptive measures and concentrate on wellness versus treating ailments?
Well, I think it's critical. It's critical from your health standpoint because you don't have to have heart disease. You don't have to get diabetes. And we live in a world now where I mean, the statistics are staggering. When you look at adults over 18, 50% of our population is either pre-diabetic or diabetic at this point in time. The longer you go in as pre-diabetic, the more likely you are to become a diabetic. In fact, there's a good study out there that shows that for every 1 point above 84 that your fasting sugar is, you add a 6% chance of being a diabetic in 10 years. Which means that when you're at 99 and your normal doctor says, okay, you know, you're normal, you're not pre-diabetic, just eat a little bit less carbs, they're ignoring the fact that that's 15 points above, you know, above 84. 15 times 6 is 90. You have a 90% chance of being a diabetic in 10 years. Well, I don't want to be a diabetic in 10 years. I need to do something now in order to begin to, because if you're diabetic, you're on insulin, you're on meds, you're on insulin, and then you get all of the diabetic complications. And I don't want those.
So how would you go about helping a patient to reverse that?
The first thing that we do is my patients fill out a series of health questionnaires because in part what we are is a information management business. So we need good information. With good information, you make good decisions. After that, we determine what labs to be drawn. When those are back, then they come in for their first visit. Their first visits are an hour and a half. So I spend more time with my patients than the 6 minutes or 8 minutes that you spend with the regular doctor because learning and changing lifestyles and moving towards health is a complex, difficult process. Well, I'm not even necessarily a difficult process, but it probably requires that you begin to think about things differently. After that, then, we'll have found other areas that need to be concentrated on. So whether it's gut issues or hormone issues or, in general, inflammation issues or looking for toxins, all of those will be indicated, at least initially, by what we've done.
Okay. With your experience as an ER doctor, how do you think the ER can improve to maybe integrate some of these practices in order to lessen the burden of people coming to ER for what should really be routine visits to the doctor?
Well, I think, I mean, so what happens is there is care out there at many levels, and even for people who don't have any insurance and who are in Title 19, there is care out there. In fact, we had an initiative when we were at Sinai where what we did is we were actually not treating everybody that came to the emergency room. We were making an initial decision as to whether or not they had an emergent medical condition. And if they didn't, we then had a system where we got them back to see their doctors or a doctor in the community. There is care there. The problem is a lot of times you don't know. It has nothing to do with your socioeconomic background. So you have pain. You have pain and you've been now pain for 3 days and it's getting worse. What do you do? Even if you do have insurance, you call your doctor, and what does the office tell you? The office tells you, I have an appointment next week, Wednesday. Well, you know what? It hurts now, and it hurts worse than it did yesterday. What do? I go to the emergency room. And that happens a lot.
True. So if someone outside of not needing immediate emergency care, but if someone is thinking about making the transition to more wellness practice, to preventative medicine, if someone can take one initial step to better improve their health, what do you think that would be before coming to you or any other doctors? What's a good basic thing for people to change?
Again, I think you have to go back to what are the four pillars of good health. And if they're not moving, you need to start moving and exercising. Exercising can be walking. I mean, if you're not walking, get out and walk to the mailbox and back and do that 2 times tomorrow and 3 times the next day. I mean, that it's not exercise going to the gym and working for an hour and a half. It's wherever you are, moving more. It's eating healthy. And eating healthy is, if I were to put it into one word, it's eat less carbs. The next thing is to avoid processed foods. The next thing is to sleep. You need to sleep. If you're not sleeping 7+ hours a night, you need to do the things that you can do to do that. And what, I mean, some of those things are, if you have a TV in the room, take the TV out of the room. If there's 18 lights in your room from your clock and other things, get rid of those. You need to sleep in the dark.
Right. So I'm curious, after being in the ER for almost 30 years and transitioning to this, in what ways do those two positions fulfill you?
I love the emergency room, and it's like doing lacerations and fixing problems and taking care of heart attacks is very fulfilling. On the other hand, now, I'm fascinated by the fact that we can actually fix things. We can actually help reverse some things. There's literature out there. You can actually reverse heart disease. And this literature is where they actually measured people. They had cardiac casts, and they showed that there were plaque formation in their arteries already. And then over time, you can actually show that plaque becoming less. This is fascinating. And you can take care of symptoms. I mean, one of a part of my practice is bioidentical hormones. We live in a world where, as of early 2002, the Women's Health Study came out and said that hormones caused cancer, increase in cancer. Well, what it was synthetic progestins, not even the equine estrogens that were given at the time. There's good, reasonable literature showing now that bioidentical hormones given appropriately not only don't cause cancer, but may be cancer protective.
Well, Dr. Flip, this is some really great insights and also advice for all of us to keep in mind. And I'd like to thank you for coming in today.
All right. Thank you.
Dr. Philip Troiano, also known to his patients as Dr. Flip, practices preventive medicine in Glendale. You can find out more information about him and his monthly lecture series at WUWM.com.
One more break, and then we'll talk with Carmel Michael, Canadian-American singer-songwriter, the one-time Racine resident, has a recently released album, and we'll hear some tunes from it. Plus, she will play in the Lake Effect Performance Studio when we return with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. It's been 5 years since the last studio album by Carmel Michael. The Canadian-born singer-songwriter spent her high school and part of her college years in Racine, though today she lives in Cape Breton, Nova Scotia.
But she was back in Wisconsin in May for the U.S. launch party and concert for her new album, Daughter of a Working Man. We're hearing the title track from that now.
Before I got my hands tied, but I didn't. No, I didn't.
But looks or sounds can be deceiving. This song, which opens the album, is not completely representative of how the rest of the album sounds. In fact, the album is so diverse it would be hard to pick one track that is its defining sound. So we invited her to stop by the Lake Effect studio to share the story of the new record. Carmel Michael, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me again. It's great.
It's delightful to have you back. And I wanted to start by asking you about the first song on the new album. It's the title track. It is darker and more dissonant and maybe more layered than much of what we've heard from you before, and maybe darker and more dissonant than a lot that follows on this album. So why did you want to set the scene in this way?
Daughter of a Working Man started out as a really simple folk song, just acoustic guitar, you know. But I wanted to use it as a way to introduce the lyrical themes that are going to be on the album, but also to really mess with the idea of what folk music is. Because I really think that we're in a time where we have so many tools in the studio and we can do a lot of things, and it doesn't change what the core of a song is. So there's everything from a 100-year-old pump organ on this song to a digital effect. So we kind of just took the whole spectrum of what we could use to paint color onto something that I felt was a strong core, the song itself, and then really do basically everything I dreamed of, you know? And it was incredibly fulfilling creatively to make.
Well, and it's such an interesting point because I think a lot of us think of folk as a sound, mm-hmm. and that the sound is equal to the genre. But if I get the point you're making, it doesn't have to sound like the Kingston Trio for it to be folk.
Exactly. I mean, I think the core of folk music is that, first of all, there's a narrative element to it. And second of all, that it's about the subject matter of it at its heart is something that is about people, the lived experience, and a common people, you know, like a majority sort of. And that's what the theme of this album is, like people up against a system that's bigger than them or up against injustice or loss or some kind of struggle and how they react. And sort of every song takes a different angle on that same sort of setup. And Daughter of a Working Man is that moment of decision. It's a person saying, I stood on the edge of something, I looked down, you know, I could have been broken by it, but I didn't. And that the real refrain for me in the song is the repetition of I didn't. That making that choice, I think, is very powerful.
What was the catalyst for that song?
I actually started it almost a decade ago. And I wrote it during a time when there was just a lot of struggles in my personal life, including my father was really ill and dying. And it was just one of those times where you sort of decide if you're going to take the reins or if you're going to sort of stop, you know, and get buried by things. And people face far worse issues than I've had in my life and have to make that same decision. I think that it's an important moment in your life anytime you come up against something like that.
The album is really, it's a diverse album. I mean, you know, there's a lot of diversity in this first song alone, but mm-hmm. then you kind of shift gears throughout the course of the album, and it feels to me like a musician exercising her muscles in some way.
Yeah, thanks for noticing that. You know, to be honest, I've always had trouble making an album that is a specific genre because as a writer, I explore a lot of different things. Like I write with pop songwriters, I write with Celtic fiddlers, I write with blues guys. I've just done so much writing. And for me, the core is the songwriting. So whatever comes of it, I just really wanted to be able to create an album where the thing that connected the songs was the storyline or the theme, not the music, really. And for me, it all does, when you get to the end of the album, there is a cohesion to it. But for sure, there's a lot of different things on there. And I think that's a really interesting way to make a record.
You mentioned traditional fiddling, and that shows up. I think it's in Spirits.
Yes, the most traditional one. Yeah,
and you are from Cape Breton, where there is a lot of that fiddling mm-hmm. going on, but that is not strictly speaking what we normally hear from you.
That's true. I had spent a couple years doing some specific projects for Celtic Colors International Festival, which happens in Cape Breton every year. And they sort of commissioned me to work as a contemporary songwriter with some traditional fiddlers, pipers, and create new music that melded the genres, which is something that I wanted to do. It was like kind of an idea I gave the festival, and they're like, sure, go for it. So a couple of the songs from that project ended up on this album. So you see this mixture of storytelling, songwriting, and then fiddle tunes coming in. And I find that mixture very interesting. I love that sound. I think people really like it because they're used to the sort of funness of the fiddle music, but the song anchors it a bit.
If the measure of a man is the thickness of his blood, I'll sink right to the bottom like an anchor in the mud. Whether captain at the table or feeding on the crumbs, I've been waiting on the bounty of a ship that never comes.
Is there much of a crowd for more traditional singer-songwriters in Cape Breton? I kind of imagine you surrounded by people who are step dancing.
That's the thing. I mean, I am a strange Cape Bretoner in that, first of all, I don't come from Scottish heritage. My parents were what you call come from a ways. My father was from Chicago, my mom from Montreal. I grew up on like Bob Dylan records. But around me was this sound, and it has influenced my writing. I mean, the narrative of like these old Scottish Irish folk ballads is very visible in my writing.
So fill my cup, boys, with spirits and good luck. Send me off, boys, with spirits and good luck.
Well, at the risk of taking that as a transition, there's a song that you brought along your guitar. And you're going to share one of the songs in the studio for us. What can you tell us about Caroline?
Caroline is a song that was inspired by something I saw while I was on tour in Western New York State a few years back. It's sort of a long story, but basically I went into a gas station there to stop and ask for directions. And I saw this poster. There was about 10 posters on the wall of missing persons. And one of them just stuck with me. Her name was Caroline. And a couple days later, I wrote this song for her. I don't really know anything about her, but something about her stayed with me.
She was born in the season when the geese go flying. Her mama was selling, her daddy was buying. She came into the world like a little bird crying. Name for her mama who was nearly dying, Caroline. Proud to a fault like her daddy was mean. Tall and thin like her mama had been. Lives like a lover at the age of 16. Chasing those taillights down the Carter Green. She wasn't no cherry, she wasn't no dove. Wise and wicked in the ways of love. Twice under the table and once above. Never let you catch her with her boots undone. Caroline. Now she's 5 years gone. And baby, don't the world go on. Yeah, she's 5 years gone. And baby, don't the world go on. Baby, don't the world go on. Of dawn, Blue Ridge Mountains where her mama comes from, Utah desert and the killing sun, Hollywood heat where the coppers run. Someone tell the papers what's going down. Someone write a letter to the city crown. Searchlight seeking, but she never found. Just a pretty face on a poster now. Oh, oh, Caroline. Now she's 5 years gone. And baby, don't the world go on. Yeah, she's 5 years gone. And baby, don't the world go on. Yeah, she's 5 years gone. And baby, don't the world go on. Baby, don't the
Carmel Michael in the Lake Effect Performance Studio with Caroline. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
There's another track on this new album, which is really, as we're talking, not long into the world. Mm-hmm. And we really ought to talk about it, that you have the first video from the album goes along with it. It's called Hold. And really, it's an anthemic little tune.
It is. You know, this song started a few years back and it sort of gained momentum, especially if you look around what's happening in our world in the last, you know, couple years. There's been a lot of changes and developments that make, sort of unfortunately, make this album or make this song more relevant than it even was the day that I wrote it. But it's about something that I think doesn't really matter what era it comes from. You know, the video is basically the lyrics of the album overlaid over archival footage of human rights protests, basically, from recently and the whole last century. And to me, it's very interesting that we keep repeating history. It's interesting that human nature allows that to happen. It's interesting that we have a short memory for things and we keep trying to do the same mistakes over and over again. And at the same time, people keep cohering into communities and fighting. And that is, to me, the most optimistic thing that you can remember is that history repeats in a negative way, but it also repeats in a positive way, and that people don't give up. We hold together. We fight for a thing. I mean, this is a powerful idea. And I hope that no matter how sort of like depressing or far apart your political ideas might be from what's being represented in the world, there's always this idea that people can come together in masses, ask for change, and elicit change.
Out of the middle of the anarchy, out of the city like a refugee, everybody's telling me to give up, give up, give up. Out of my head finally, as close to the heart as I'll ever be, even when they're telling me to give up, give up, give up. We gotta hold.
Do you have to be at heart an optimist at some level to be able to be a songwriter?
I think that if you aren't, it can eat you up, you know? I mean, there is no shortage of deep, dark places to go and sad things to focus on in the world. And it's important that sad stories get told. It's important that injustice gets talked about. But it's also important that we, again, it goes back to this idea of choice, that we make the choice to use it as a motivator.
Everybody's telling us to give up, give up, give up. Throw their money into the streets. Give me something I can keep. Even when they're telling us to give up, give up, give up. We gotta hold. We gotta hold.
We mentioned that you live in Cape Breton. You're from Cape Breton, but there is this period in your life where you were a resident of Racine, Wisconsin, which is one of the things that brings you here today and brings you back to Wisconsin now and again. I read an interview you gave with, I think it was a Nova Scotia breakfast blog called Déjeuner, which for my money is the best name for a blog in the history of the internet. But you were talking about the election in the U.S. that's just passed. And I guess, do you have dual citizenship still?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's your feeling about that American side of you that spent some formative years here as you watch this stuff play out from someplace that's fairly distantly removed from the mm-hmm. States, even from Maine?
I feel very connected. I am, I think in my heart, because I was born and raised till the age of 14 in Canada, there is a part of me that is my home, you know. But as you say, I was here for formative years and I have a lot of my family lives here. I care about it in a way and I'm connected in a way that is more so than someone who, I mean, not only my dual citizenship, but I just care about it. I'm very connected culturally to the American voice of a songwriter and the American voice as a writer. I study American literature a lot, and a lot of my heroes are American artists. And I think you can't know or understand American literature without knowing or understanding American politics and culture. They're just intrinsically connected. I care very much, but I'm also very careful about the fact that I don't live in this country. And so my concerns and my opinions have limitations because I don't live here. And I think that that makes me an outsider of a kind, you know, even though I am a citizen, there is a sense of outsider. And I respect that distance that I have. And I don't like to step on, you know, step on the toes of people who perhaps these decisions, their political ideas affect them in a different way because they're here and they live on the ground, you know. It's a complicated relationship I have with this place, to be honest. It's like someone that you kind of keep having conflict with but keep coming back to. And there's no easy way to really describe it.
Well, I want to take us out with another track from the album. Before we wrap up, first let me say, Carmel Michael, it's always great to see you, and I hope you'll come back and see us again.
Thank you so much for these great questions. Great discussion.
What can you tell us about 1969?
1969 is one of my favorite tracks. I'm so happy that you're choosing this one. Again, really special experience in the album. It was just recorded me at the piano. I had actually never played the song on the piano before. I did two takes. Suddenly the song made sense.
This house is aching and the winter's proud. The wind is blowing our patience down. I've been counting, I've been.
And we sent it to a man named David Langstroth, and he heads up a quintet called the Rhapsody Quintet, and they arrange strings to the exact track, the way I played it, any weird thing I did. They did an amazing job, and it was always been a dream of mine to have this kind of strings arrangement done on a song, and I'm so, so pleased with what they did. It's a really special song for me.
Put a man on the moon. It don't seem right. It's you and me tonight. And I can't get to you. No, I can't get to you. And you're just across the room.
Well, it came out really well. And I'm glad we can share it with folks. Thanks again.
Thank you.
All the windows are freezing up. The air is heavy.
Singer-songwriter Carmel Michael was born in Canada and today lives in Cape Breton, Nova Scotia. In between, though, she spent her high school and some of her college years in Racine, Wisconsin.
She was back in Racine in May for the U.S. launch of her new album, Daughter of a Working Man. You can see a picture from her studio session and find a link to more about Carmel Michael and the new album at WUWM.com. That is the Thursday edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie Knorr. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Please be with us again Friday morning and Friday evening at 10 for Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It is 11 o'clock, and stay tuned because Fresh Air is next.
Oh, I can't get to you, and you're just across the road.